a couple of drag lines 120 degrees apart on the ground. Believe it or not, one human being could have put that up with the right kind of arrangement. Block and tackle pulling it up on the roof, and two dragging lines 120 degrees apart on the ground, and they come to pull these over to you where you're standing. So one arm is pulling the block and tackle with some kind of a mesh block assembly, not a, trying to think of the name of the thing. Schumacher ascender is what they call it in the non-hearing business. A jam cleat, where the rope can slide through in one direction and not slip back. So you can be pulling on the block and tackle with your left hand. Your right hand is holding on to these two ropes with pulleys to go over to the two stakes in the ground where the guys are 120 feet apart to make sure it can't swing to one side. And you could have picked it up. We did it with a bunch of manpower. Sounds like a good arrangement. And you said you got one of these for VHF and one of those for HF. That's a nice tower arrangement. About the only thing I is not ideal is that you can't climb that tower. It doesn't have legs on it, and it doesn't have cross pieces like a real tower. And but my guess is you could lower it again by the exact same process. In fact, you could make a block and tackle arrangement by which you could lower it if you needed to for service. And I presume there's something like a ham end or a ASU rotator on the top of the mast that then rotates all of this. Is that true, Glenn? Go ahead.
82JXM. Recognize the station.
Yeah, JXM, we'll pick you up with in a minute. Go ahead, Glenn, first.
Yes, on the HF small mast, small steel tower, I'm using a tail twister high gain rotor, the GX2, and on the VHF I'm using the 45, I think they call it the TD45, which is just a little bit smaller rotator. That's bolted on from there. The other thing is that to service it, I did do one thing I didn't explain. The main tower, where it's supported and guides, is fixed. So what I did was I bolted the side of the, I have another steel pipe, you know, it's 2.5 inch, that bolts side by side to the mast that's just at roof level and above, like 5 feet above the roof, to 25 feet. So the house is roughly 18 feet at the gutter, up to about 25 feet to the top at 6. Then I drilled 5 holes on the, through the steel pipe to another steel pipe with stainless steel bolts. So I'm basically joining the steel pipe from the roof up directly to the one that's parallel to the house. So if I want to, I can loosen the top 4 bolts and then just use the swing arm and it will drop down on the roof so I can service the antennas. Back to you, Dick. Case where I got to
see that sounds like a nice serviceable arrangement. You should be pretty happy with that. And you're now getting a stronger signal because of the higher gain or because of the greater altitude? Which do you think it is, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, aside from just doing, impedance testing with my antenna analyzers, the first antenna that's in operation that I'm transmitting on right now is the tri-band, which is the antenna I've been using all along. That's what I'm using here tonight. Right now I'm only on 5 elements vertically polarized points towards the repeater. The other antenna is the horizontally polarized 13 element 2 meter and the 19 element 7 centimeter antenna I haven't really experimented much with, but I'm going to be trying to be DXing the sideband hopefully this week. Back to you.
Yeah, last night and portions of tonight the 2 meter band was in very good shape. Some extended ground wave and whatever that people are talking about. So, have some fun with that. Okay, I think Gary is next at KB2JXM. Let's see how the signal is from you, Gary. K2RIW on the tech net.
KB2TS, I've just got a comment to put in. Not does it have to do with what Glenn said, just a comment.
Yeah, let him go, because I'm going to be a little long-winded.
Go ahead with the comment.
Okay, last week in the tech net, I asked if there was a way I can improve signal quality on 2 meter using a very little amount of money. You said you had talked to a guy about getting information, and you told me that you would tell me the next time I got into the net. Can you just tell me the guy's call letters again, because I The downwind zone hasn't been down anywhere. Can you tell me what you got? K2RWKC2TSS.
Very fine. I'm looking for, yes, that's Danny. It's the same guy we talked to you about last week. Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo, WA5DJB, Whiskey Alpha 5, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo, Kent, .callletters.com. When you go to that website, you go to the right place on that website. At first you're going to see the antennas that he sells, which are printed circuit antennas. And you go to the right section of that website. He has there his past articles on the coat hanger Yagi for 2 meters. So we told you about that website last week, and now we're double sure. I talked to Kent about this not only last week, but also earlier this morning. And you go to that website, you will see the design for the coat hanger Yagi with very inexpensive materials. That's going to give you a lot more gain. So back to you, Danny. KC2TFS, I think it is. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I'll tell him where you can find the advertisement first.
Mel, why don't you give me that information? I'm not quite sure what you're saying. The C advertisement, go ahead.
Well, Kent had an article and the construction of that antenna called the Chief Yagi. It was in fact, I just talked to Kent a couple hours ago, Dick. And he had the article in CQ Magazine, July 2005. CQ Magazine, get a hold of a copy if you can see it, put together a Chief Yagi. And his email is wa5djb@cq-amateur-radio.com. Over.
Okay, but I think that antenna that you're describing that was in the past issue of 2005 CQ Amateur Radio, I think that antenna design is also on his website, wa5djb.com. So as I see it, Danny, when you go to that website, or write an email to Kent. And when it comes to antenna questions, Kent at his website, which you can also find him on QRZ.com, WA5DJB, he has for lots of years been writing antenna columns for CQ Magazine, for the German Magazine, for the British Magazine, for the Central State VHF Society, for the Microwave Update. He's got lots of antenna articles, so when it comes to antenna questions, certainly consider going to Kent by any one of the means you can get to him. Let's see if Danny needs a fill in any of that information. KC2TFS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, there's only one problem with the Yagi. If I use the Yagi, I need to use a rotator in order to point it at the repeater because Yagi is a directional antenna. The only problem is I've been looking at the prices of some rotators. My dad says it's a trademark for us to report right now. What alternatives to that do you can you tell me? K2RW, KC2TFS in the TechNet.
You've got at least two alternatives there, Danny. One is that if you want to make sure you've got good coverage to whatever is your favorite repeater, you aim the Yagi at that repeater. That's one approach. The other approach, whatever means you use to support the antenna, and maybe it's going to be a pipe alongside of the house, an aluminum pipe, a steel pipe, a copper pipe, you could bring it down to the ground or pass through a window of where your ham shack is located, and you reach out the window and rotate the pipe. We call that an Armstrong rotator. My first 6-meter, 6-element Yagi that I built way back in the late 50s, the dark ages, had an Armstrong rotator. The pipe came down near the cellar window. I would reach out the casement window with my hand and rotate the pipe and pick up the signal I was listening to. So that's a rotator that's very reliable, very fast in rotation, and rather inexpensive. The only price is going to be the support pipe that comes down to the ground. And you're going to need a piece of pipe regardless of how you mount it on the chimney or whatever, whatever gives it altitude. So consider that as a possibility. Back to you, Danny. Casey, by the way, there are television rotators. See, the antenna you're putting up is not very substantial. It's only going to be a pound of antenna with a 1 square foot of wind load, so to speak. There are some rotators sold by Radio Shack, among other people, where the rotator is intended to rotate a very small television aerial. You don't need one of these huge ham radio, ham M, or a tail twister type things that are $800. There are rotators for $49 and maybe even below that are intended for rotating a small television aerial. You're rotating a small aerial. It doesn't have to be a real beefy rotator. KC2 TFS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I'll be sort of working at Radio Shack. The only two problems is I use more than one repeater in 2 meter. I use maybe 5 or 4 different repeaters normally. And where I'll put the antenna up on the chimney, yeah, that's it. And where my bedroom window is, which is where I operate my 5 meter, 2 meter, 5 watt HT, you have to make a left turn because it goes down in the where the chimney is to my window, then not a line. So it wouldn't just be straight down, and it's not in a good position in order to do the Armstrong rotator that you mentioned. So the only alternative would be to buy a cheap rotator at Radio Shack, which I'll definitely look into. Now, the other thing is, how do I know where to point the antenna? Do I have to know, the latitude or the longitude, whichever one it is, I can't remember? Or do I just keep turning it until I pick up the signal? KC2RWKC2TSS.
You can certainly do the second one. Rotate until your signal gets strongest while you're watching some kind of a signal strength indicator. That's one approach. The other approach would be just to use a road map. Use a road map that includes Long Island, if that's where you are, and I think you are, that includes your town. And also on that road map, with a little bit of talk to your friends, you'll find out where this repeater is located. This repeater is located right on the border between Nassau and Queens, very close to where Northern State Parkway goes by those particular buildings. So again, you'll find that on the map, and therefore almost every road map you can get your hands on, north is straight up, and so you could draw yourself a compass rose on the map and easily figure out the angles, or use the trigonometry they taught you in high school and draw a straight line between the repeater location on the map and your location on the map. And knowing that north is straight up, there's various ways you can draw lines on that map and calculate the angles using trigonometry. And when it comes to the inexpensive coat hanger Yagi that you're about to build, the antenna is going to have something like a 45 degree beam width to it. If you aim it to the nearest plus or minus 30 degrees or so, you're in the right general direction of the repeater. And from there, with the rotator control, making it go a little bit more clockwise or counterclockwise, and either listening for the signal strength by disconnect the antenna connector so that just a little bit of the signal gets through to the receiver and it's slightly noisy, or putting in a real attenuator, or watching a real signal strength indicator. There's lots of ways you can peak the antenna on the right direction, and there's lots of ways you can measure signal strength. So that in itself is a bunch of fun experiments. So Alliant is one of the companies that makes very inexpensive rotators. They make a rotator where there's a pipe coming in, through the rotator that you mount the rotator to. There's another pipe going through the center of the rotator that gets rotated. And those two pipes are almost parallel to each other. Let me turn it over to Mel, because I bet you he's got a couple of suggestions for inexpensive rotators. And maybe the Alliance 150 is one of the inexpensive ones. But I seem to remember Radio Shack may make an even less expensive one. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Roger, this is K2KEY. I don't think Alliance is around anymore. Maybe wrong, but I think they have gone out of business making that rotor. I don't know if the company even exists. But you see a lot of them. Boy, garage sales, I have seen them so many times. It's just garage sales, you know, where they cut them down off the roof and sitting there for $5. I don't know how many of them I've purchased at a time because we use them for the smaller system, you know, at the field day. We have the field day at Floyd Bennett. I use an Alliance rotor that I picked up that many of the people have said to us that I think I got one laying in my garage. So you go to Hamfest, you know, you always see them there for a few bucks. And even some of the original CDE, you know, Cornell Dubilier stuff, smaller ones, CD45 and all that stuff. You'll see them also many times at Hamfest. Way to what we do at my field day, quick aim of our antennas, is from the roof, just look at the Empire State Building. You can find the exact setting for the Empire State Building. Any map of New York area, you know, any of the borough maps and all, where the Empire State Building is in relationship to your house, the angle, or whatever you want to call it, you know, what the deviation is of north or east or whatever it happens to be where you're located. But so they can see it by from the roof, there's a good place to line your antenna with it. Over.
KB2JXM.
Go ahead, Gary.
Am I coming in full quieting? Because I'm low power right now.
Yes, you are coming in very well, Gary. You're about to make a comment on this, and then as soon as we finish with Danny, we're going to come over to you. Over to you, Gary.
Oh, no, I thought you forgot about me. The last comment turned into a long story. No, you go ahead and finish, and I'll sit here and wait.
Very fine. When it comes to flea market, one of the very popular items that I, just like Mel was saying, you'll very often see at flea markets are used rotators. There's a flea market coming up on Sunday, October 26th, by Limark at the Levittown Hall in Levittown, Levittown Parkway, Hicksville is where it's really located, but it's called the Levittown Hall. So Sunday, October 26th, is going to be a good-sized flea market, indoor flea market at that Levittown Hall. I don't know if there's any other flea markets coming up. There's probably one coming up between now and then for the Hall of Science. Maybe you know about another flea market coming up. Is Hall of Science coming up fairly soon, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW?
Oh, I have to look in QST. If you're looking QST, I'll tell you about him all the time. So, yeah, I know the line market is coming up. Is the Hall of Science got another one? I don't remember. Went to the previous one. I believe it was in June. So I don't know if they're going to have another one. I can say, take a look at QSC. You'll get all the conventions. But I can say there's plenty of rotors. I don't remember a convention that I've been to that I didn't see at least a couple of rotors. I can say they're very common at most of the conventions. In fact, the last one you mentioned, the Limark one, guy had there an old MM1 that he said was perfectly working. He really just had it hooked up. He said he could demonstrate it working. And he wanted to sell that thing for about, he asked originally $100. The guy, I think, made him an offer like $75 or $80. And I think he took it over.
Ozark Hamfest, October 5.
Good to know. So October 5, and most likely that's a Sunday. Is that true? Okay, Hall of Science, Hall of Science Ham Radio, October 5, which is where the World's Fair was way back in the 1964-65 time frame in Flushing Meadows, I think it is. So there's at least two flea markets coming up in October in which inexpensive locators should be available, Danny. So good luck with that project. Let's go over to Gary, KB2JXM, K2RIW. You got it, Gary.
KBTSS, thank you very much. I just got a sign out of the net, and that's it. Got it. K2RIW, KB2JXM, back to make the throw over to Gary. I don't know what's up.
Okay, I guess I got it now.
You finally got it, Gary. Go ahead.
long time. Okay, this is kind of long-winded. It's more or less like two problems in one, but it all started a couple years ago. A friend of mine gave me a GP15 by Comet. It's a tri-bander, 6 meter, 2 meter, and 440. And the thing worked okay for a couple of months, and then I started to notice the SWI meter jumping around, and you know, it's going from 1.3 to 1 to 2 to 1, 1.7, 1.9 to 1, and, you know, at will. Tried another coax, and it's doing the same thing, so I took the antenna down, and I put up another one, and I just left it in the basement. About a month ago, I was on vacation up at Harriman State Park in my grandmother's cabin for a couple of weeks, and I brought the thing with me and the radio. I put it up there, and sure enough, you still have this intermittent SWR bouncing around. I thought I'd take the antenna apart. I had my tools with me, and it slides out of the fiberglass barrel, and you know, you can see everything. You see the three loading coils, seven capacitors, and all the traps. Everything looked well soldered. Everything looks fine. I put it back up again. Still intermittent SWR jumping around. So I must have taken that thing apart five times and still the same problem. Well, I took it apart on the sixth time. I laid it on the wooden table out there, and I keyed up, and it's still intermittent. But what I did do is, if, you know, I mean, how am I going to explain this? Nothing really goes wrong with the coil. There was no shorts on it. All three loading coils looked good. The insulators looked good. Dielectrics looked good. You just don't really know what's going on inside the capacitors, even though the capacitors look good. So what I did is I hung it from a tree. It had a nearby tree. I hung it from the top of the antenna to a tree. And the match was good. It stayed good. No more intermittent SWR. So I figured there's a gravitational stress point somewhere on the antenna, but I could not find where at that time. Okay, so that's the way I operated. I just put the whole thing back together again and put it up there and used it with this intermittent SW1. Worked okay. When I got home, I tried it the next day out on my deck. All of a sudden, I'm getting a match of 7 to 1 on 2 meters and 440. I'm not using 6 meters, so I really don't care about that.
Repeater, timeout.
Okay, for the last 2 minutes, you had timed out the machine, but I heard you everything you said because I'm listening on the input, Gary. And the main thing that as you're trying to select that exploded capacitor and you're putting in your own substitute capacitors of various sizes and you measure VISWR across the 2 meter band and the 440 band, I think the trimeter is, 6 meter, 220, 2 meter and 440. You're trying to select the right capacitor, and when you change the length of coax cable, you got different standing wave ratio readings. What is the nature of the ground plane radials on that antenna? There are a number of vertical multiband antennas that have either none or very meager kinds of ground plane radials on them. As such, the coax cable, the feed line, does become hot, and therefore the length of the cable will affect the radiation pattern and the standing wave ratio. So before I proceed, tell me what those ground plane radios look like on that antenna. Back to you, Gary, HULIW.
Okay, sorry about the timeout. I forgot about that. Okay, there's three ground plane radials on it. They're, two of them are stainless steel, I would say somewhere around 18 to 20 inches long. The third one is a little thicker, and it's adjustable, which I believe was adjustable for 6 meters only. It's not all that adjustable, though. Being that it is for 2 meters, I'm sorry. Being that that one is adjustable for 6 meters, I didn't really touch it. I know what you're talking about because I tried that also with taking the radials off, putting them back on again. There's not much of a difference.
Okay, you did say two of the stainless steel radios are 18 to 20 inches long. 19 inches would be quite a wave at 2 meters, and those should be two reasonably good counterpoise ground plane radios for the 2 meter band, and it's 2 meters that you're measuring right now. I'm also curious as to how many watts you were putting into the antenna. I'm having trouble believing you were putting enough watts that should have exploded that capacitor. Sounds to me like the capacitor could have been a mechanical failure, and I'm guessing if you went to the right website and or the manufacturer, there may be a way of finding out what was the value of the capacitor and the type. Many antennas use a transmitting grade capacitor, so that putting the right value of capacitor in there to give you the right VISWR only brings you halfway home, so to speak. You also want to be using a capacitor that's rated for that particular service, and maybe you're putting 50 watts into the antenna, and unless it's a pretty beefy transmitting grade capacitor, you may be setting yourself up for another failure downrange when the radome is over the antenna and it doesn't have as good a heat radiating capability as the capacitor on top. So is there any possibility of finding out from the manufacturer? I think you said it was TP15. I'm not familiar with what brand name that is, but let me throw it open to the net. If anyone's got a suggestion as to the best way to find out the value and type of that capacitor, you can replace it with one that's rated for the service. Anyone have any suggestions on that? Give me a call. Let us right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
500 volts, all of them.
Okay, so it's a 500 volt rated capacitor, and the one that you're putting in, do you believe it also has that kind of transmitting grade rating? Gary, go ahead.
When I put in, it's bigger. What they used is disc, the brown disc capacitors. Probably they use those because it has a low EWR, ESR. 500 volts. The one that I put in is got to be at least 1,000 because it's twice the size, and I was going to put something in even a little bit bigger, but I can't physically because then you can't slide the antenna back into the barrel. So that's, I had to use at least 1,000 so this doesn't happen again. The wattage that I was using was 3 watts. My radio only puts out max 45 watts. The antenna itself is rated for 150 watts. They're little brown disc capacitors that you might find in, the old style TVs type of a thing. Now, a friend of mine had the exact same problem, exact same antenna, and his exact same capacitor, which was the third one from the last loading coil, his also exploded. He put in a silver mica, but I said, what about the ESR? And he didn't have an answer for that, but that was going to be my next step. I do have a 10-puff, 1,000-volt silver mica. That's one good thing about the capacitors with very low values. You can use high-voltage capacitors, 500 volts, even a little bit higher, because the capacitance itself is very small. Back to you.
That's amazing. You're only putting in 3 watts or 45 watts max. and that certainly should not have created a failure. I'm guessing that the mechanical flexing of the antenna created a mechanical failure of that capacitor as opposed to electrical failure. Then again, it's possible, because of the way the antenna resonates, that there's a high current point at that particular capacitor. Silver Mica, by the way, in my opinion, is a high-quality capacitor. ESR stands for Equivalent Series Resistance. And almost every Silver Mica capacitor, which is, as I said, a high-quality type capacitor, I think they all have equivalent series resistances that's quite small. I wouldn't worry about that. And a disc ceramic capacitor also has rather small stray inductance to that particular style. So, again, I wouldn't worry. Mel, have you heard of failures of capacitors like that? And if you were doing a replacement, would you be replacing it with a 500-volt or 1,000-volt disc ceramic? And I'll bet you you wouldn't worry about using a good silver mica. And if you want to be double darn sure, if, for instance, you're putting in 12 picofarads, you could make that up with a pair of 6 picofarad capacitors in parallel, and whatever the series equivalent resistance is of those capacitors, by having a pair of them in parallel, you're going to get one-half of that amount of resistance. So one way or another, you're going to come up with a high-power replacement that should never fail again. Let's see if Mel's got some suggestions on this one. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Roger, this is K2KEY. I have used those 500 silver mics in a number of different experimental antenna arrangements, both cross coils and whatnot, and I never blew one up. I was running a lot more than 1545 watts. I was very doubt that with the power that he was averaging running there that he would able to destroy that capacitor. So 500, in fact, they sell 1,000 that are basically 1,000-volt ones that are basically the same size today with modern material. So I would doubt that I would more or less agree with you, Dick, that it sounds like something like vibration or fatigue of some sort taking place in that antenna to destroy the capacitor physically rather than electrically. Go ahead.
Gary, I'm also curious as to how you are continuously monitoring the standing wave ratio to watch it bouncing around. Very few guys on 2 meters do that. You must have had a bird watt meter or something like that continuously in line looking at reflected power because you knew something funny was going on with the antenna. So I think many of the substitute capacitors you're putting in there right now should, as long as they're mechanically strong enough not to give you another failure, I think electronically you're not going to have any problems. And as I said before, silver mica usually is a quality capacitor. KB2JXM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, you are absolutely correct about the mechanical stress of the capacitor, and you may be right about that its current high. Because after I replaced that capacitor, there was no more intermittency. I have no problem whatsoever. Yes, I do have a 10-pop silver mica, which I was going to try next, but the problem is fixed, and what cued me on that was when I hung the antenna from a tree, and the SWR was fine, and no more intermittency. Why I brought the SWR meters with me is because I wanted to see if I can solve the problem up at the cabin. So I had to bring those with me. I brought two of them. I have a MFJ and I have a diamond. I was surprised at the diamond's operation. It's a very good meter. If I go from low power, medium power, medium high, or high power, you know, jumping from 3 to 45 watts, and I recalibrate it, flip to reverse, it still reads exactly what it was when I was running 3 watts in the SWR reading. I was surprised. Usually they don't do that. But this one was consistent. Yeah, KB2JXM. Did I answer all your questions? I'm not sure. I think you asked me one more, and if so, please ask again, and then I have to get into the other problem of the coax length.
Yeah, you've answered all my questions, Gary. Now, when you use short, long, and medium length coax cables and you measure different VISWARs, tell me, what are we talking about here? Did a 2 to 1 go to 1.7? Or did a 2 to 1 go to 4 to 1, so to speak? What kind of sensitivity were you getting in magnitude of VISWAR versus length of feed line? Back to you, Gary.
Okay, very good, very good. I have three coaxes. When I got home from vacation, I put the radio and the antenna out on my deck, and I tried all three coaxes, because I've gone through that before where a different coax length gives me a different reading of SW1. But it looks like, and once again, it looks like I'm going to have to go with a non-resident length, because reading three different SWRs does not tell me if I got the right capacitor in there for balancing the best SWR between 440 and 2 meters. So I definitely have to solve this coax problem first. The first coax that I was using was, well, it is the RG59U, which is 50 ohms. It's the mobile coax. It's 109 inches long, which is not really cut for a non-resident length. I think I'm maybe a foot off. My second coax is RG213, which is the base coax, and that is, I believe that was, it's either 30.5 or 32.5 feet long. Third coax is RG59U again, which was, let's see if I got this right, 60.5 feet long. And when I take, when I go measure out the first Q section of using 2950 times the dielectric constant, which is 0.66 divided by 146.5, I come up with 13.33 inches for my first lambda. Let me drop. Okay. So I haven't cut any coaxes yet. You can get out your calculators, because I'm parked in the mobile right now. I don't have a calculator with me. But let's see here. 13 times 33 times, I think it was the seventh multiple for the 109-inch coax was close to 110 inches. Okay, and then the second coax, which was the RG213, was, let's see, I think I'm using the 29th multiple for that one. The 60.5-foot coax, I believe I was using the 54th multiple on that one. Now, again, none of these coaxes are cut to a non-resident length, but I believe I'm going to have to do that in order to, you know, solve the coax problem, and then from there I can finally size a good capacitor for the antenna.
Okay, you've fallen into a trap, Gary. You've been listening to your buddies on some band that are giving you a tall tale, a very logical-sounding tall tale, and that is lots and lots and lots of hands believe there's a magic length of coax cable. Quarter wave, odd number of quarter wave, half wave, even number of half wave, non-resonant, resonant, whatever. Everyone believes that there's a length of cable that must be used in order to make a valid standing wave ratio measurement. Absolutely, positively, dead wrong. No, not true. Lie. Put it any way you want. Wrong. Erase that. Don't remember that. Forget it. Ain't true. I think you're getting the point. Standing wave ratio is caused by having a transmission line, and I think every one of the transmission lines you just mentioned are 50 ohm lines. If the end of that line had an antenna that acted like a 50 ohm resistor, your coax, your power from your transmitter would flow down that line once, hit the 50 ohm load at the far end, be absorbed by that load, whether it be a dummy load and it goes into heat, or whether it goes into a 50 ohm antenna, and the signal gets radiated to space, but the power would flow once. If the far end of the transmission line has anything but a 50 ohm resistor, it could be a perfect 50 ohm capacitor, no good, a 50 ohm reactance capacitor, a 50 ohm resistor with a little bit of capacitor reactance, a little bit of inductive reactance, or a 42 ohm resistor, whatever, anything but 50 ohm pure resistance, will by a calculatable manner, I can give you an equation for that, will create a certain amount of reflected power. And the amount of reflected power, when you plug it into the right formula, we interpret it as standing wave ratio. But the real point is that anything but a 50 ohm resistor, let me drop, on the far end of that cable, will create what the cable considers a partial mismatch, and some power will be reflected. Let me give you an example that's easy to understand. Stand in front of any storefront. You go down to your shopping center, and you stand in front of one of the stores, and you look at the glass window at a grazing angle. And you realize that the glass is a partial reflector. It's a partial mirror. You can look into the glass and see what's going on at a grazing angle by reflection off of that glass. What's happening is that the light in the air is going through 377 ohm impedance air. Some of it hits the glass. The glass is some of the impedance, and therefore a reflection takes place. Your eye sees that as a reflected image in the glass. Well, a similar thing happens with the coax cable. If the coax cable had another length of 50 ohm cable or a 50 ohm resistor, there is no reflection. Anything but that is a reflection. The reflected power comes back down and is sensed by your standing wave ratio meter. There's nothing magic about the length of the cable. If your antenna is going to reflect 10% of whatever power you put into it, because it happens to have that particular standing wave ratio that creates 10% power, you're going to get 10% power reflected, whether the cable is short, long, whatever. The only thing that really changes is that as the cable becomes longer and longer, unless it's made out of a magic cable, it's got more and more loss. Because a longer cable's got more loss, you will see a little bit less power getting to the antenna. The same percentage of power is reflected by the antenna, but now it goes through that loss a second time, coming back down into the shack where your meter is. Therefore, the reflected power with a longer, lossier piece of cable, the reflected power will be lower, and you'll see what looks like a better standing wave ratio. But if you looked at the right curve in the book that tells you the loss of the cable, or you did the right kind of a calculation, you could figure out what's going on at the antenna when you know your cable's got 1, 2, or 3 dB of loss, if you know what I mean. So, changing the length of the cable does not change the percentage of power the antenna reflects. It will a little bit legally change the amount of power you see back at the shack and interpret as this one because of the insertion loss. Now there's an exception, and that is if your standing wave ratio meter has an imperfection, and that imperfection is called directivity. An ideal standing wave ratio meter, when you have it in the forward mode for calibrating, should look at forward power and be thoroughly non-sensitive to reflected power. And vice versa. When you're in the reflected power mode, measuring this one, it should look at reflected power only and be thoroughly insensitive to forward power if the meter has high directivity on those two detectors. But the world is filled up with standing wave ratio meters that have marginal directivity. In the forward mode, it's responding a little bit to reflected power. In the reflected mode, it's responding a little bit to forward power. Now, when the meter has that kind of leakage, lack of ideal directivity, now whether or not the power flowing in the other direction is in phase or out of phase will make the meter read higher or lower than reality. In that case, when you've got a meter with imperfect directivity, changing the length of the cable changes the phase angle of what comes back, making it in phase or out of phase at the point of your meter, with in phase or out of phase at the power that's going forward, and therefore that leakage either adds or subtracts. The visuar apparent will go up and down as you change length of cable if you have a less than ideal meter. So lots and lots of guys believe they have the world's best meter. They change the length of the cable. They see the visuar go up or go down, and they say, aha, that's what everybody's been telling me. There's a magic length of cable that'll give me the right visuar. Not true. Because when that meter has leakage, there's all kinds of ways it can have leakage. It can have leakage that's in phase or out of phase or in quadrature, so to speak. So I can get two different brands of meter that have a lack of directivity, leakage, and I'll find two entirely different lengths of cable that give me the so-called correct visual reading. So there is no magic length of cable if you have an indirect, imperfect meter. So now, when you think back, where you had a longer piece of cable that had more loss, is that the one that measured lower visual? And by the way, there's an easy way of measuring the directivity of your meter, and that is put it into a perfect dummy load, something that you know is a one-to-one standing wave ratio. Does it read one-to-one? And, just to be double damn sure, hook the meter up backwards and repeat the measurement. And do you still get reasonable readings? You can measure directivity if you've got an ideal dummy load. Once you find out that your meter has high directivity, then the length of cable really doesn't matter, other than its insertion loss. And that lowers the reflective power apparent, if you know what I mean. If you do measure lack of ideal directivity, there's ways of retuning the meter. As you can tell, Gary, there's more to the story than first meets the eye. What else is new? That's why you came to the TechNet. That's why...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You came here because Mel and Dick are verbose, long-winded guys, but they give you some of the information you've been looking for, that your life has not been quite as good as it could have been because you were lacking some of this information and you were hearing a whole bunch of misinformation in the past. Mel and Dick don't give you misinformation. You don't believe that? I'll tell you another. KB2JXM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2JXM.
That was a triple. Gary first. Go ahead, Gary.
Okay, thank you. No, you're right. That's why I came to the TechNet. I'm not saying anybody is wrong. I'm just, you know, listening and learning. We do have another station out there. So maybe I can just wrap this whole thing up saying that out of my three... Oh, okay, you're asking, was my longest coax the highest reading SWR? No, it wasn't. Actually, it was the shortest one. That was 109 inches. I started off with that one at about 2.5 to 1. That's when I first started with using different capacitors in the antenna. But to summarize this whole thing, I think what you're saying, and I understand what you're saying about the directivity, and yes, I did use a 50-ohm load on the back of the SWR meter with no coax whatsoever. And I did read about 1.4 to 1, but it's a dummy load that I made. I made it with a whole bunch of parallel resistors, and they're not shielded. So that might be at fault right there. I'm going to have to get myself some kind of a good shielded dummy load. Okay, one more thing. Out of my three coaxes, because of the length of coax giving me a different phase angle, I think what you're trying to say is stick with one. Pick one and stick with it and do my capacitor balancing act for the antenna with one of them. Because if you don't want to mess with the... Well, what the heck is this? Oh, this is so cool. Wow. I'm up here in Garrett Mountain. We got about 6 deer crossing the road over here. I thought they were dogs. All right, anyway. because of the phase angle, and you just bypass that, forget the phase angle, and just pick a coax.
K2JJ with a comment.
JJ recognized, one of the three people. Before we do that, though, the fact that you measured the highest standing wave ratio on the shortest cable, and the shortest cable is the one with the lowest loss, the lowest loss means you're going to see the strongest reflected signal, therefore the highest visual, that all comes together. And you had it backwards. You thought I was saying the longest cable is going to give you the highest visual. The lowest loss cable is going to give you the highest apparent visual if you didn't correct for insertion loss of cable. And the fact that you made a homebrew dummy load and you measured 1.4 doesn't tell us anything. Homebrew dummy loads tend to have a 1.4 or a 1.2 standing wave ratio. And by the way, your dummy load doesn't have to be a high power thing. If somebody gives you a 50 ohm attenuator that's got 10 dB of loss, a 10 dB attenuator with nothing on the far end, the signal goes through, gets 10 dB attenuated, hits the open circuit, comes back again through the attenuator, gets another 10 dB of loss, you're going to get a 20 dB reflection coefficient, which is around a 1.15 or 1.16 visual. So even a 10 dB attenuator, if you got one of those, is not a bad dummy load. So getting a hold of a good dummy load is relatively easy. JJ, and there's another person. JJ first, go ahead with your comment.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Doug here. Just to clarify something, did Gary say he was using RG59 coax? If so, that's a 75-ohm cable. You know, not a showstopper. It'll work, but if he's looking for absolute, you know, measurements into a 50-ohm load, that's going to give him some reflected power. Maybe he misspoke and meant RG58. Dick, back to you.
I did. I made a mistake.
No, I heard RG58. I heard him say RG58, so I don't think that's a problem. Who was the other person who signed in? Give me the call letters again.
W2IGH.
Go ahead, Hugo.
Yeah, hello, Dick. I've been listening to you all the time, but I haven't been checking in. But earlier, I wanted to go back. There was a fellow on here. It didn't get right down his call, who wanted a rotator. Now, I have a heavier rotator than a TV rotator, which I haven't been using for quite a long time. But the last time I checked it, which was several years ago, everything worked, the indicator worked, and it was rotating. And I would give it to him. I don't even want anything for it. So could you give me his call letters? Maybe I can give him a call. If he's still on, it would be all right.
Bravo, Hugo.
Well done, Hugo. Hey, that's a great dedication, Hugo. That was Danny. I think Danny is a high school student. My guess is he's away doing homework or sleeping at this time. Kilo Charlie 2. Tango Foxtrot Sierra. Kilo Charlie 2. Tango Foxtrot Sierra. Sierra is Danny. He told us he had to sign out. He's most likely not here. But by way of QRZ.com or whatever, or him coming back next week, you two guys are going to get together. And great dedication. I can tell he's a little shy on funds, but high on enthusiasm, and it's hard not to get involved in that. Back to you, Hugo, in case you need a fill on that. W2IGH, K2RIW on the TechNet.
I'm in.
Who was checking in? I was a little bit quick. See that I have it. Okay, Dick, very good. I have KC2TFS, Tango Foxtrot Sierra, and I will give him a call. I'll get his phone number, and I'll give him a call, and he can have that rotator. I hope it still works. The capacitor in the indicator may have to be changed because it's been a long time, so it might be bad. But he can have that, okay? I'll get in touch with him. Thank you very much, Dick. Back to you.
Amen.
Yeah, who's saying comment? Go ahead with your comment.
Yeah, if anybody needs an Alliance rotor, I have, this is Gary, KB2JXM. I have an Alliance rotor in my attic that I'm not using if anybody needs it. I don't have the control box, but I believe, oh, I would say 95% that I do have that rotor for, in my attic if anyone needs it.
Another good offer there, Gary. Although him being just starting off, to have a rotator without the control box would be a difficulty for him. He's a high school student, just getting into ham radio for the first time, as Danny was talking about. Okay, good luck with that get together there, Hugo, and great dedication. Now, as you can see, Gary, what I'm saying is that the fact that you measure the higher VISWA on the shorter cable is the one with the lower loss, that's exactly the way a VISWA meter should be behaving. If you are a real true scientist, you will measure the length of your cable in feet. You go to the right lookup table or the right website that tells you the dB per 100 feet of your cable. It calculates the insertion loss of your cable. You then take the raw standing wave ratio measurement you got out of your meter and correct it for the insertion loss of the cable. And I can tell you how to do that. And there probably is a section of the Radio Amateur's Handbook or the ARL Antenna Book that'll tell you how to do that. There's a curve I remember where you plug into the curve, insertion loss of cable, you plug into the curve, the VISWA that you measured, and then on the other axis it tells you what is the true VISWA. But once you know the formula for VISWA, and you know that each VISWA of a known number, like for instance a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, means that the percentage of power reflected from the antenna is something like 12%. Minus 9.5 dB is the reflection coefficient for a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And if your cable had 1 dB of loss, 1 dB on the way out, 1 dB on the way back for the reflected signal, it will have 2 dB of loss. The minus 9.5 dB of reflection coefficient would become minus 9.5, minus 2, minus 11.5, and now that new VISWA would not be 2-to-1, it will be something like 1.8. You can see the way it works. I worked it forward, you'd be working it backwards. You'd be measuring 1.8 and recalculating that it's really 2.0. So once you understand that standing wave ratio really is a reflected power ratio at the antenna, that's what VISWA really is. If there's any reactance at the antenna, or if there's any error in the 50-ohm resistive component of the antenna, then you're going to get reflected power. That's just the way transmission lines work. And for years and years, we keep interpreting reflected power as standing wave ratio. Nowadays, all network analyzers measure decibels of reflection ratio, and that's much closer to the truth. If we all almost abandon a standing wave ratio and go back.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
We'd all be one step closer to the truth if we essentially abandon the archaic measurement of standing wave ratio. We just keep doing that because of history. But in reality, the real nature of what's going on is a certain reflection power because of a certain degree of mismatch. And the reflected power is the truth. To take that and reinterpret it back into standing wave ratio, because that's the tradition, it's a little bit crazy. It's time we start abandoning that tradition, in my opinion. So now, once you measure the reflection coefficient, once you measure the insertion losses, or calculate or look up the insertion losses of your type of cable and the number of feet of it, you may discover that all of your VISWAs are really the same once they've been corrected, in which case there is no difference for length of cable. And what you are about to do, look for that magic length of cable that is non-resonant, is really a waste of time. It's got nothing to do with the problem, even though 90% of all the guys you encounter on 20 meters are going to tell you that. And boy, this is one area where there's huge error between what everyone tells each other and what's really going on. You read the appropriate chapter of W2DU, Walt Maxwell's book on his his book on Reflections on Reflections. You read the appropriate chapter, and you'll discover, boy, is there more untruths in this area than there are truths.